very important reason. The Israel-Palestine has been so difficult to solve is that fundamentally, we are not dealing with a political, territorial, religious, cultural, or ideological problem. We are dealing with a psycho-spiritual problem, a problem of the psyche or mind and of identity.
That's Richard Forer, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Richard Forer on psycho-spiritual roots of the Israel-Palestinian tragedy. In Sanskrit, Maya means illusion, magic. Maya is at work among people and nations who project carefully crafted positive images of themselves. The United States and Israel are no different from other countries. They claim self-defense as they launch massive attacks. They invoke international law when it suits them, then ignore it when it doesn't. Then there's always the standard line about our so-called values, which justifies their actions. Most people don't have a clue about Israel-Palestine because they depend on heavily biased corporate news. Instead, they cling to shop-worn myths and fantasies about themselves and their country. The Gaza bloodbath is enabled by the United States. Are we good Germans, pretending not to see? Our guest today is Richard Forer. He's spent time in the West Bank and Gaza. He has Orthodox Jewish relatives living in West Bank settlements. He's a former member of AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, the influential lobby. He's the author of Wake Up and Reclaim Your Humanity, on the tragedy of Israel-Palestine, winner of the New York Big Book Award. He spoke at the Chinook Center in Colorado Springs in late April 2024. And now, Richard Forer.
I first want to announce that I am no more pro-Palestinian than I am anti-Israeli. I am pro-human rights and anti-oppression. If the roles of the two sides were reversed, I'd be doing exactly what I'm doing now, except that I would be advocating for Israeli rights. But if I were pro-Palestinian, I would be justifying oppression. If enough of us, and this is really critical, if enough of us, especially lawmakers, took the time to educate ourselves, I don't think it would be that hard to find a solution to the Israel-Palestine tragedy. But we cannot trust the mainstream media, whose so-called experts have proven themselves expert at repeating Israeli propaganda and ignoring the historical factors that led to Hamas's Al-Aqsa flood on October 7th. Of course, Israeli loyalists do not want to know the history because they see Israel the way they want to see themselves, as fair and humane. Therefore, history that portrays Israel as unfair and inhumane is a mortal threat to their self-imagery or ego identities. They would rather send their children to war than inquire into their imagery and their unexamined beliefs. They would rather be right than make peace. 11 days after Al-Aqsa flood, President Biden flew to Tel Aviv, where he hugged Prime Minister Netanyahu, whose lifelong obsession has been to ethnically cleanse the land of Palestinians, and who, during the Obama-Biden administration's first term, tried to sabotage a second term. So what was Biden to do? His certainty that, quote, were there no Israel, America would have to end one, would have to invent one, end quote, his standing as possibly the largest, or at least one of the largest, congressional recipients ever of money from the Israel lobby, his lack of knowledge, and his attachment to his self-imagery as both the empathetic president and a proud Zionist made him a sucker for Israeli propaganda. And what could Biden say to the traumatized families whose deaths, mutilations, and homelessness his empathy helped to produce? He says he gave Israel the means to defend itself, but he really gave Israel the means to avenge itself. He could have told Netanyahu, "We will not allow you to turn Gaza into an island of ruins. 75 years of contempt for international law is enough. It's time to make peace and bring the hostages home." And if Biden was oblivious to the blood-curdling screams of genocide from Israel's political, military, and religious leaders, when it finally dawned on him they meant what they were saying, why didn't he stop arming Israel? Even after Biden admitted that Israel's invasion was, quote, over the top, meaning more genocidal than he thought it would be. Even when he admitted that Netanyahu was, quote, an he continued arming Israel. Moreover, despite no evidence to support its allegation, Biden took Israel's word that 12, later reduced to 6, then maybe 0 UNRWA employees, United Nations Work and Relief Agency employees, participated in the October 7th attack, and he cut off funding to the humanitarian organization in Gaza's most desperate hour. So in addition to all of his other poor choices, in his hubris and seduced by his self-imagery, he allowed himself to be suckered into helping Israel starve the Gazan population. Throughout its existence, Israel has been contemptuous of Palestinian life. I'll give you an example. On Saturday, December 27, 2008, Israel bombed the Gaza Strip and started Operation Cast Lead. At the same time, it simultaneously violated its ceasefire that it had with Hamas, and it violated the Jewish Sabbath. Exactly 2 weeks later, on another Jewish Sabbath, Israeli officials blocked life-saving humanitarian aid from entering Gaza, insisting they could not violate the Sabbath. Israel killed more than 1,400 people in Gaza, including 344 children. 36 children were killed during Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, and nobody knows how many were killed by Israeli fire and how many were killed by Hamas's fire. On March 30th, 2018, Gazans of all ages gathered near the fence separating Gaza from Israel for the Great March of Return, where they declared their right to live in dignity and called on Israel to give them the freedom to return to the towns and villages their families were expelled from in 1948 and 1967. Over 100 meters away, on the Israeli side of the fence, safely stationed behind earth mounds and lying in wait, were highly skilled Israeli snipers who proceeded to kill 58 Palestinians, all unarmed, including children, and injured 3,000. The next, and by the way, the snipers used bullets fabricated to leave survivors maimed for life. And many of the survivors had to have their legs amputated. Snipers were shooting at their legs. Many of them had to have their legs amputated because Israel for years has not allowed much of the modern medical equipment that most hospitals would have to enter Gaza, so they didn't have the equipment to avoid amputation, and Israel wouldn't let them go to Egypt, the West Bank, or Israel for leg-saving treatment. So the day after this slaughter of 58 people, the IDF, Israel Defense Forces, tweeted, quote, "Yesterday we saw 30,000 people. We arrived prepared and with precise reinforcements. Nothing was carried out uncontrolled. Everything was accurate and measured, and we know where every bullet landed." End of quote. A couple days later, the Foreign Affairs Director, Eli Hazan, said that the 30,000 nonviolent demonstrators were, quote, "legitimate targets." And Defense Minister Avigdor Lieberman explained, quote, "You have to understand, there are no innocent people in the Gaza Strip," end of quote. And for Israelis who worried that the scene at the border could get out of control, Shin Bet, the Israeli security agency, Shin Bet director Avi Dichter, had very soothing words, quote, "The Israeli army has enough bullets for everyone," end of quote. During the next 12 months, snipers murdered 277 Palestinians, including 52 children, and injured 28,000. By advising Biden to greenlight Israel's invasion, Secretary of State Blinken put his loyalty to his Jewish heritage ahead of his loyalty to his country. On his first trip to Israel after October 7th, he told his host, "I come as a Jew," meaning, "I'm one of you, I'm part of the tribe." On at least three occasions, I heard Blinken say that a Palestinian child's life is as valuable as the lives of his own children, but obviously not as valuable as Israel's right to defend itself against children. I wonder how Blinken would feel if his children had to have limbs amputated without anesthesia. With their attacks on Yemen, Syria, and Iraq, their refusal to condemn Israel's attack on the Iranian embassy in Damascus while condemning Iran's reprisal, Biden and Blinken have signaled their willingness to go to World War III in defense of Israel's final solution to the Palestinian problem. And if those two foot soldiers were tone deaf to Israel's calls for genocide, they still had to know that that was the intention, because in addition to Israel's multiple attacks on Gaza since 2008, each time where they deliberately targeted civilians, Israeli prime ministers, chiefs of staff, and others have admitted to that intention. In 1948, with David Ben-Gurion — for those who don't know, Ben-Gurion is the founding father of Israel — in 1948, with Ben-Gurion's approval, Yigal Alon, the most prominent general in the 1948 war, wrote, quote, "There is a need now for strong and brutal reaction. If we accuse a family, we need to harm them without mercy, women and children included. Otherwise, this is not an effective reaction. During the operation, there is no need to distinguish between the guilty and not guilty," end of quote. The late Ze'ev Schiff, who was revered throughout Israel's political and military spectrum as its greatest military analyst, said, quote, "The Israeli army has always struck civilian populations, purposely and consciously. The army has never distinguished civilians from military targets, but purposely attacked civilian targets," end of quote. Rafael Eitan, Israel's longest serving chief of staff, said, "I don't believe in peace, because if they had done to us what we did to them, we would never make peace," end of quote. I have a question. Does anybody in this room sleep with their shoes on? The reason I ask is, when I was in Gaza in November 2012, random Israeli gunfire killed 13-year-old Hamid Abu Dhaka while he was playing soccer on the dirt road in front of his house in the village of Abasan Kabira, which is about a mile from the Israel-Gaza border. The next day, my delegation attended the boy's funeral. Afterwards, when we walked back to our bus, a group of villagers was waiting to speak with us. And one middle-aged woman said to me, "Do you sleep with your shoes on?" Knowing that her question was rhetorical, I asked her if she slept with her shoes on. And she told me that Israeli helicopters, drones, and tanks enter Gaza as often as 6 days a week, and when they do, they fire indiscriminately in all directions to scare away anyone in the area, which is how Hamid got killed. And she told me that these intrusions are so terrifying that many people sleep with their shoes on so they can jump out of bed at a moment's notice and run to safer areas. I mean, imagine living like that for your entire life. Now I'm gonna tell you a bit about how I went from being a member of AIPAC and a staunch defender of Israeli policy to where I'm at now. Until July 2006, I believed that the cause of the Israel-Palestine problem was the Arab world's non-acceptance of a Jewish state in its midst. And I believe this non-acceptance was a result of hatred of Jewish people, their culture, and religion. On July 12, 2006, Hezbollah killed three Israeli soldiers and abducted two in a cross-border raid into northern Israel. Coming just 3 weeks after Hamas had captured Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit on the Israel-Gaza border, I saw these provocations as proof that the Arab world would not rest until Israel was wiped from the face of the earth. So the next day, Israel invaded Lebanon, and I supported the invasion, but I was deeply troubled. So I decided — by the way, I saw myself in the place of these innocent soldiers that Hezbollah, had attacked. I regarded myself as much a target for terrorists as Gilad Shalit and the others. So the day after that attack, Israel invaded Lebanon. I supported it. But I still felt troubled about what was happening. Not that Israel was invading Lebanon, but I was troubled about the hatred that seemed to be coming towards Jews, which is mostly an illusion. So I decided to speak to my two of my closest and wisest friends, neither of whom was Jewish. I wanted to convince them that my fears about the Arab world were justified. I knew that both of my friends had been critical of Israel in the past, but this time I was certain, given the circumstances, that they would agree with me. But to my amazement, they blamed Israel for its disproportionate use of force against the people of Lebanon. Their reactions demoralized me. Neither one of them had much sympathy for what I had to say. Afterwards, when I was alone, I carefully went over each conversation in my mind. I wanted to see if there was something I had missed, something I hadn't understood. Finding nothing, I solemnly concluded, drum roll please, that only Jews can understand the suffering of our people. Then a week passed, during which I calmed down a little bit because I spoke with Jewish friends whose like-minded views softened my anxiety, and I attended a pro-Israel rally where there were a bunch of non-Jews, which felt kind of good, because now that meant that maybe the Jews aren't so isolated and hated in the world by a bunch of anti-Semites. But then I received an unexpected call from an old Jewish friend back east. Sammy was calling to tell me he was coming out west and planned to visit me in New Mexico, where I was living at the time. After agreeing to the visit, I immediately launched into at least a 2-hour diatribe against Israel's enemies. And Sam just listened, barely saying a word, never arguing. However, unlike me, he had actually studied the issue for many years. Toward the end of the diatribe, but he was very low-key about it, toward the end of the diatribe, he suggested I read books by two very well-respected Israeli professors, of course I'd never heard of, Baruch Kimmerling and Tanya Reinhardt. Because Sammy didn't resist my point of view, he gave me the space to begin to question the belief system I had taken for granted my entire life. Until that moment in 2006, believe it or not, and actually it's very common, it had never occurred to me there was more to understand than I already, more to know than I already knew, or that studying the subject could add to my understanding. So we hung up and I went on Amazon and I looked up books by Kimmerling and Reinhardt. I also compiled a list of other books on the subject with the stipulation that I would read Jewish authors only, knowing that otherwise I would suspect bias. What I could not have foretold was that I was about to uncover a lifetime of bias within myself. So I drove over to my library and checked out a few books from my list. After a week of fairly uninteresting reading, I picked up Beyond Chutzpah on the misuse of anti-Semitism and the abuse of history by Norman Finkelstein. With barely an idea of what I was getting myself into, I began reading. Thus began a conscientious study of the history of Israel-Palestine. My singular commitment was to the truth, and I knew that in order to separate fact from fiction, I had to give equal attention to both sides of the debate. And I was not about to allow preconceived notions to influence my understanding, my research. Finkelstein's sources were mainly mainstream organizations, such as Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and the Israeli NGO B'Tselem. And their reports were a serious indictment, all of them, a serious indictment of Israeli behavior and policy. Documented charges included the use of deadly force by Israeli soldiers against unarmed men, women, and children, the bulldozing of houses, sometimes with inhabitants still inside, and by the way, since 1948, Israel has bulldozed almost 50,000 Palestinian houses and not a single Jewish house. Okay, so, as I said, Finkelstein's main sources were these mainstream human rights organizations. In addition to bulldozing houses, they punished people, large numbers of people, innocent people collectively on the basis of alleged crimes by lone individuals, the theft of desperately needed water from Palestinian villages, and Israel's commonplace use of torture. Many of the reports Finkelstein cited could be found online, so I spent a great deal of time reviewing passages he had quoted. I was intent on catching him taking information out of context or changing a word here or there in order to present Israel in a negative light. But after hours of reviewing his citations, I had to admit that in every single case, his documentation was beyond reproach. At the same time I was engrossed in Finkelstein's expose, I was experiencing a range of emotions as I learned about the abuse and humiliation Israelis routinely subject Palestinians to. I felt shocked that a country in which I had invested a lifetime of loyalty would treat people this way. My shock turned to anger that Israel was perpetrating these abuses in my name as a Jew. I felt personally responsible, no less so than if I was a soldier in the field. In fact, an image of me as a soldier in the field arose to my mind, to my consciousness. My anger then turned inward against me, rebuking me for years of willful blindness. Shame and embarrassment followed, and then immense sorrow for a people whose cries I had been deaf to. These human beings were suffering profoundly from my ignorance. It became clear to me that every Palestinian is inherently guilty of the crime of not being Jewish. I was in the initial stages of learning that every argument I had ever made in defense of Israel was either factually inaccurate, or if there was truth to the argument, taken out of context for the purpose of blaming the Palestinians and exonerating the Jews. Feeling overwhelmed and needing a break from this repudiation of a lifetime of core beliefs, I put the book down and closed my eyes. I have no idea how long my eyes were closed, but when I opened them, I felt cleansed and free. All of the emotions I'd been suffering were gone. Their absence was so startling that I spontaneously began searching for them, as if they were solid objects that could hide in physical locations. I scoured my bookcase and the corners of my room. Where's the shock, the anger, the shame? But no sign of these emotions reappeared. So I sat back in my chair and relaxed into my newfound state of freedom and wonderment. I had nothing to do and nowhere to go. I was not interested in the past, and I was not drawn towards the future. The present was all there is. I felt a light pressure, as if a soft veil were covering my eyes. There was a soothing quality to the pressure. As I enjoyed the sensation, the veil began to unravel in a spiral motion from left to right. And when my eyes were uncovered, the world was brighter. And I realized that the world is a reflection of our internal states of consciousness. The world is an interactive or psychophysical process. The next thing that happened was a profound inner peace pervaded my being. It was everything I could have wanted. It was the heart's desire. And as I looked out, I saw that peace must be discovered within before we can discover it without. If we want to transform the world, we first have to transform ourselves. Next, I couldn't detect any fear of extremists. My enemy images of these people seemed to have vanished. But given the terror I felt whenever I heard about atrocities in the Middle East, I decided to test myself to see if these images were really gone. So I imagined myself in the place of Nick Berg, the young Jewish man who was beheaded in Iraq in 2004. Berg's beheading had horrified me, but the enemy images would not return. Instead, a whole body, warm and blissful feeling that I identified as equanimity rose up through my body, along with the knowledge that beneath their hatred, even the most bloodthirsty of extremists crave the same right to self-determination as do I. With this knowledge, their humanity that I had unconsciously denied and my humanity that I had unconsciously squandered were restored. To finally see all people as human beings is the greatest relief. I can't tell you what a great relief it was to find out what a schmuck I had been. Once the beliefs that blinded me were gone, I felt like I had awakened from a dream and was no longer burdened with the emotional pain I had taken for reality. Within the dream, the pain had lasted for a lifetime, but in this newly awakened state, it was merely a faint memory. Sensing something was missing, I then tried to inquire into my Jewish identity, but I could find neither a Jewish identity nor any other limited identity. An image of a balloon materialized, its elastic boundaries representing the limits on understanding imposed by a limited identity. The balloon burst, and the air inside the balloon equalized with the air outside the balloon, and truth was revealed. We are all Palestinians and Israelis, Muslims, Christians, and Jews. Existential fear and confusion, the hallmarks of separateness, were transformed into compassion and clarity. Existential fear is the prism through which the separate self views the world. Therefore, along with existential fear, confusion arises. Compassion is the ability to stand in the shoes of the other and see from all perspectives. Therefore, along with compassion, clarity arises. Compassion and clarity, seeking to understand all behavior, ask why the other behaves as he does. What are the stimuli for his behavior? Have we in some way provoked his behavior? Compassion and clarity understand that no behavior occurs in a vacuum and that each of us is responsible for the suffering in the world and each of us contributes to the collective mind of humankind. One reason, a very important reason, that Israel-Palestine has been so difficult to solve is that fundamentally we are not dealing with a political, territorial, religious, cultural, or ideological problem. We are dealing with a psycho-spiritual problem, a problem of the psyche or mind and of identity. It was not until I understood this problem that I was able to apprehend the astonishing reality that I had never cared about Israel, nor had I ever defended Israel from criticism, at least the Israel that actually exists. What I had defended and what I had cared about and protected, just like Israel's loyalists, including Biden and Blinken, were idealistic images of Israel that I had superimposed or projected onto the Israel that actually exists. Those projections enabled me to deny painful imagery about myself and Israel that I would have noticed if only I had looked without the influence of a mind that only saw what it wanted to see and only believed what it wanted to believe. The mind is the separate self, the identity, the ego. So here are two universal principles that are at the root of conflict and suffering, and these two principles encapsulate this understanding that I've been describing. The real enemy is not someone or something outside of us. The real enemy is the unexamined mind that unconsciously projects its suffering onto the other and then blames and scapegoats the other for its suffering. The second, the root of conflict and suffering is the attachment to a presumed, limited, and mortal, I emphasize mortal, identity, and to the beliefs and images that emanate from and reinforce that presumption. The reason I emphasize mortal is because people see criticism, if they are identified with Israel, they see criticism of Israel as a mortal threat to their self-imagery. If they are not who they think they are, how they define themselves, they are terrified. That is why I said earlier they would rather send their children to war than inquire into their beliefs and images.
You're listening to Richard Forer on psycho-spiritual roots of the Israel-Palestinian tragedy. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
The real conflict, taking this into account, is not Israel versus the Palestinian people or Israel versus a hostile world. The real conflict is the failure to integrate the hard to believe but unmistakable reality of Israel's treatment of Palestinians with unquestioned loyalty to the Jewish state. One consideration recognizes Israel's dark side. The other denies the dark side exists. I want to move on to Hamas, and I'm not a fan of Hamas. I'm not a fan of any fundamentalist organization, and I'm not a fan of any organization that often treats its people brutally. But Since 1988, Hamas has made well over a dozen attempts to make peace with Israel, all totally ignored. In 2008, Yuval Diskin, the head of Shin Bet, the Israeli security agency, confirmed that Hamas was willing to accept a long-term ceasefire on the 1967 borders. And by long-term, he was talking 40, 50 years. That same year, the Strategic Studies Institute of the U.S. Army War College wrote that Hamas had, quote, accepted the notion of a limited area for a Palestinian state and would recognize Israel in a de facto manner, end of quote. Israel has never recognized the Palestinian people or their right to a state. On June 3rd, 2009, Hamas sent President Obama a letter outlining its commitment to pursue, without preconditions, a just resolution within the guidelines set by the International Court of Justice, the United Nations, and human rights organizations. That same year, in 2009, Jimmy Carter wrote that Hamas, quote, would accept any agreement if it submitted to a referendum in the West Bank and Gaza, and the Palestinian people approve it. That means they would accept Israel's right to exist if that's in the agreement. Israel has never accepted the Palestinian right to exist. In fact, it doesn't want them to exist at all. Former National Security Advisor and former head of Mossad, Ephraim Halevi, said the U.S. and Israel could strengthen Hamas's moderate wing and engage them in a peace process. They didn't. Halevi also said, quote, if Israel's goal were to remove the threat of rockets from the residents of southern Israel, opening the border crossings would have ensured such quiet for a generation, end of quote. Israel's government refused to open the crossing. Obviously, they're not so interested in peace, in quiet for a generation. They have other goals in mind. Speaking of rockets, in the 9 years ending on December 31st, 2008, during Operation Cast Lead, Gazan groups fired a total of 8,088 rockets into Israel. That's on the basis of a right-wing Israeli think tank. Now compare those figures, 8,088, to the nine-month period, 1/12 the length of time, 9 months, not 9 years, to the nine-month period ending in June 2006, during which Israel fired 7,700 far more deadly rockets into Gaza. I want to mention something. When I was in Sderot, in 2010, Sderot is one of the towns that was attacked on October 7th. It's like a mile from the Gaza border. I saw lots of rockets that had been shot from Gaza. I saw lots of depressions in the ground where they landed. I would estimate that if I were 10 feet away from a rocket landing, I wouldn't have been hurt, or maybe injured a little by flying debris. Israel's rockets have a kill radius of up to 150 meters. That's almost 500 feet versus 10 feet, okay? So there's a huge difference between the rockets Israel launches against Gaza and the rockets that Hamas launches against Israel. A few months ago, the House of Representatives passed Resolution 894, which equates anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. Historically, some of the staunchest Zionists were anti-Semites who wanted to rid their country of Jews. And many of the staunchest anti-Zionists were religious Jews who considered a nationalist movement to create a Jewish nation heresy to the Torah, which says that only God, through the Moshiach, or Messiah, can establish a Jewish state. Pro-Israelis who equate anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism presume that you're not an anti-Semite if you deny documented history, but you are one if you accept documented history. You're not an anti-Semite if you defend Israel's contempt for international law, but you are one if you believe in international law. And you're not an anti-Semite if you rationalize Israel's cruelty towards the Palestinian people, but you are one if you have compassion for the Palestinian people, in which case all Palestinians are anti-Semites. Doesn't this narcissistic reasoning characterize the Jewish people as inhumane? But such a characterization would itself be considered anti-Semitic. In other words, the proof you're not an anti-Semite proves that you are an anti-Semite. This is the dualistic mind infected with existential fear and confusion. I want to briefly mention two of the most common arguments Israeli loyalists make to justify Israel's position and stance against the Palestinians. The first is the 1947 UN partition plan, which unilaterally took 56% of Palestine from the Palestinian people and gave it to Israel, gave 43% with only 20% of the coastline to the Palestinian people, and the remaining 1%, Jerusalem and Bethlehem, was placed in a corpus separatum to be administered by the United Nations. The argument that Israeli loyalists make is that Jewish acceptance and Palestinian rejection of partition proves the Jewish side has always wanted peace and the Palestinian side has never wanted peace. Therefore, the Palestinians are to blame for this problem. It's their fault they live under occupation. This ridiculous argument imagines that Israel would have been content with 56% of Palestine and no Jerusalem when Israel has never been content with the 78% of Palestine it has controlled since 1949. Moreover, a Jewish state under partition would have had a 49% plus Palestinian minority that would quickly have become a majority. It is utterly naive to think that Israel would have accepted such an outcome. And in fact, David Ben-Gurion, Israel's founding father, pledged to his political party that the borders established by partition were not permanent. And he said, after we become a strong force as the result of the creation of a state, we shall abolish partition and expand into the whole of Palestine, end of quote. It wasn't just Ben-Gurion. Chaim Weizmann, who was Israel's first president, who was the man mostly responsible for the Balfour Declaration in 1917, in which Israel announced that the Jews could have a homeland. Chaim Weizmann said before the partition plan was passed, and this was going on for more than a decade, where the Jewish agency in Palestine was lobbying for a partition plan and for a state of Israel. Chaim Weizmann said, the Jews would be fools not to take a piece of land the size of a tablecloth. Why? Because they knew they were going to expand into the whole of Palestine. Taking all this into account, in March 1948, 2 months before Israel became a state, the U.S. State Department warned, the Jews will be the actual aggressors against the Arabs. However, the Jews will claim that they are merely defending themselves. In the event of such Arab outside aid, the Jews will come running to the Security Council with the claim that their state is the object of armed aggression and will use every means to obscure the fact that it is their own armed aggression against the Arabs inside which is the cause of Arab counterattack, end of quote. The second argument I very briefly am going to go over is Palestinian rejection of Israel's alleged generous offer at the 2000 Camp David Peace Summit. Well, if Israel's offer was so generous, why did Israel's chief negotiator, Shlomo Ben-Ami, say, quote, the concessions offered by Israel fell far short of even modest Palestinian explanations. And he also said, if I were a Palestinian, I would have rejected Camp David as well, end of quote. Moreover, if Israel was really interested in peace, why has it totally ignored the Arab Peace Initiative, which was first introduced in 1988, has been on the table since 2002, was reiterated in 2012, and Israel has never had a word to say about it? That peace initiative guarantees security, provides security guarantees for all the states in the regions. It would end the Arab-Israeli conflict, and it would normalize relations between Israel and every Muslim country on earth, all 50 of them. So why is it that in the name of peace, so many people rationalize Israel's refusal to make peace? Why in the name of justice do so many people rationalize Israel's unjust policies? Why do they protect Israel from accountability for its crimes and give it the means to perpetrate those crimes? Are they evil or are they terrified of the truth? But is not because they are evil. It is because in their existential fear of inquiring into their presumed identities, they are confused and they suffer deeply, even though they are unconscious to their own suffering. This is why I say that the real enemy is the unexamined mind that projects its suffering onto the other and then blames and scapegoats the other for its suffering. Years ago, an old man in Gaza stood on a corner holding a placard. I always cry when I read this, on which were written these words: "You take my water, burn my olive trees, destroy my house, take my job, steal my land, imprison my father, kill my mother, bombard my country, starve us all, humiliate us all, but I am to blame. I shot a rocket back." End of quote. I want to end with a short quiz. I'm going to read a quote that includes the word Yid. For those who don't know, the word Yid is a derogatory name for a Jew. And you're going to guess who said this quote. Now, I'm going to give you a hint. The person I'm quoting was male and lived and died in the first half of the 20th century and was extremely well known to the worldwide Jewish community. Here's the quote. "Yid is anti-Zionist. We have known him for a long time. And just merely to look at him, let alone approach or, heaven forbid, touch him, was enough to make us feel sick. The Yid is a hideous distortion of the human character, something unspeakably low and repulsive. The Yid is the curse of the Jews. Watch out, Yid." End of quote. Any guesses? No, but I'll give you another hint. This person who made this quote, his birthday is celebrated as a national holiday in Israel. Any other guesses? Theodor Herzl. Theodor Herzl, the founder of political Zionism. He was an atheist who detested religious Jews. He did not circumcise his son. He even went to the Pope and said, "If you help me get a piece of land for the Jewish people, I'll convert them to Roman Catholicism." Okay, most of the Zionists were not religious. Now there are religious Zionists like Bezalel Smotrich, for example, who's the one of the coalition members to Netanyahu. He's religious Zionist. And I think Ben-Gavir, who's in charge of security, he may be religious Zionist, or maybe he calls himself just a formal Zionist, but they're both religious. Okay, that ends the talk. Does anybody have any questions?
I deeply appreciate the description of your spiritual awakening. What would you propose to do as a first step toward transforming this situation? What else?
Okay, first of all, as I mentioned and strongly implied, we're not going to reach the people who are strongly identified with Israel. We need to speak to people on the fence, okay? People on the fence, when they hear a logical, intelligent, sane, humane argument, they're going to see what's real. But the people who are like I was at one time, forget it. You're not going to reach them. To give you an example, I'm still in touch with many Jewish people I grew up with, who I went to even nursery school with. But almost all of them will not pick up a book. They will not even read my book, and they think they know more than I know, even though they know they've never studied the issue, and I have. And they know that I'm smarter than them and always was. They know it. Okay? So I can't even reach them. Okay, so first of all, lobbies. We got to get rid of these lobbies. The billions of dollars that goes into perverting the system, the political system in the United States, is obscene. The fact that AIPAC is not even listed as an agent of a foreign country is also obscene. But in my opinion, any dark money should be eliminated, which means Reverse Citizens United, the Supreme Court decision that the Republicans supported. We've got to get rid of these lobbies and purify the political system. If this were 1938 Germany, and there was an AGPAC, American-German Public Affairs Committee, most of our congressmen and Biden and Blinken would be supporting Adolf Hitler. When I say ethnically cleanse, for most people in Israel who support what Israel is doing, which is over, this is something like 98% supported Israel's invasion of Gaza, 68% right now do not want Israel allowing humanitarian aid in the country. They want to starve these people to death. Almost 60% think Israel has been going too easy on the Palestinians since they attacked, okay? Education is very important, but again, we see in this country how the Republicans in the red states are trying to prevent, really, you can't even read Huckleberry Finn in school. You can't read To Kill a Mockingbird. They're really trying to maintain the myths the myth of the lost cause, for example, in the South. They don't want their children growing up thinking that Southerners, Southern whites, supported slavery and that the Civil War was a battle to end slavery. They want people to think that the Civil War, that the South's participation in the Civil War was a noble battle for states' rights, okay? So they're training, just like they do in Israel, they are training their children to not be in touch with their humanity and to separate the world into us against them. That is what they do in Israel. And they do it so severely, I have seen numerous videos online of Israeli soldiers, young Israeli soldiers, mostly in their 20s, bragging, I killed 22 children and I'm gonna kill more. And then the reporter was saying, you're a monster. And it didn't faze him at all. He was so happy that he had killed all these cockroaches. Because Israel has trained its people to think of the Palestinians as subhuman. The language its leaders have used, I mentioned Rafael Eitan, Israel's longest-serving chief of staff, who said, if the Palestinians had done to us what we did to them, we would never make peace. Okay, so I mentioned him because he used to refer to Palestinians as cockroaches. Other prominent Israelis, generals and politicians have called them beasts walking on two legs, human animals, crocodiles, all kinds of horrible things. They really dehumanize them. Anyway, so we've got to start with education. Now, I'm not particularly confident that this is ever going to get any better. I see Israel maybe moving towards using a nuclear weapon against Iran in the future. And I see this world becoming so polarized that that we're going to destroy ourselves. Maybe we're going to destroy ourselves just through the environment. But all I can say is I don't do this because I think I'm going to have success promoting the cause I support. I do it because it's the right thing to do. And maybe in some dimension, in some time, what I do, what all of us do, will somehow reverberate throughout history and have some kind of effect in the future.
Even if we take out the red state folks like DeSantis who are trying to purify the university system there, we have the elite universities, Ivy League and elsewhere, where right after October 7th, the billionaires that were funding their schools were pulling their money out, and then Congress eventually called in the presidents of the universities. And now, Columbia, Harvard, University of Southern California are taking the lead in silencing all protest. And I mean, it's not just that it's not an educationally conducive environment, they're crushing independent thinking in the universities. How do we move past that?
That's a hard question to answer because a lot of the funding comes from the money that donors bequeath, and a lot of the donors are Jewish. And I have always said that when someone's identity, Jewish or not, but when someone's mortal identity is threatened, there is nothing they will not do to defend themselves, to shut you up, if even just the words. When I criticize Israel and I make an argument against Israel to my friends or my relatives, which I don't do anymore, it's a waste of time. But if I do that, they feel so threatened. They're not that conscious of how they feel deep within, but they are so threatened because when I criticize Israel, as I say, their presumed identity is fused with Israel. Israel as a safe haven for the Jewish people, as the innocent nation that represents Jews, is part of their identity. So when I challenge them, it's as if they're facing a mortal threat. They're about to die because their belief is part of how they define themselves. If that belief is wrong, that is a form of death. That is why so many people, not just with the Israel-Palestine issue, with all kinds of issues, so many people would rather send their children to war, to kill or be killed, than inquire into their presumed identities or into the beliefs and images that constitute their presumed identities.
When you're talking to your relatives and such, and you're trying to convince them and argue or make points, do you listen to their views? In other words, don't express your view.
Right.
Don't put your view in there, make your points and look for things to say, but listen and empathize and
no.
Come, oh, well
I'll tell you what.
Then you are not communicating with them.
That's right.
Then you have a wall.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
It is very difficult, especially with family, especially
of course.
Especially with my
I'm
identical.
Not saying it's easy.
especially with my identical twin brother, who's an Orthodox Jew, okay? There is no way of getting through to him. In my first book, there is a chapter on my dialogue with my twin brother, okay? Now look, some people, you just can't reach. When my nephew calls me up, he goes, "Hi, Richie, how you doing? Let's not talk about Israel-Palestine." And so I don't. I honor his wishes. I'd rather have peace in the family. It's a very difficult thing.
Oh, I know.
Someone here mentioned nonviolent communication. Let me just say, I once attended a 10-day retreat with Marshall Rosenberg, the founder of nonviolent communication. Marshall was there with his top trainers, the ones who had started with him from the very beginning. They had arguments, and they couldn't solve their own arguments. Now, Marshall, and I'm telling you,
that whole ego thing.
Of course,
because we don't get what we want.
The ego is persistent. The ego lives to preserve itself, aggrandize itself, and validate itself. There is no way that you can come from the ego and really solve anything. It's such a spiritual practice to surrender the ego. And sometimes you can do it, sometimes you can't. If you're really triggered, as Marshall would say, you need to give yourself a lot of self-empathy before you can speak to that person. I want to give someone else a chance to ask a question. Yes, ma'am.
Let's go way back, 1,000 or whatever, BC. Jews have been treated badly. And I'm wondering, where does this psychology come from?
Well,
and or why, what started it?
Well, the fact that Jews have been treated badly is a part of the reason why the Jews felt they needed a state of their own.
I understand.
But I have to clarify something. As I mentioned about Herzl being totally anti-religious, Zionism was a movement that very few Jews subscribed to. And in fact, there would not even be an Israel if not for the fact that the Zionist organization blocked FDR's plan in 1944 to take in, between the United States and Western Europe, 100% of Holocaust survivors. The Zionist organization blocked it. And there was a poll taken at Dachau concentration camp after the war ended. Only 15% of the Dachau survivors said they wanted to go to Palestine. In the 1920s, more Jews emigrated from Palestine than emigrated into Palestine. So Zionism needed real deceit in order to create enough of a demographic of Jews in Palestine to create a state. And that's what they did. They blocked FDR's plan. So yes, it's part of the Jewish psyche, you could say, people who are brought up with these stories that the Arabs have always hated Jews. It's part of their psyche about the having to destroy the Amalekites and the Jews had to fight all these different tribes. It's in the, you know, in the Old Testament. But that's no excuse for not examining your own thoughts. It's no excuse to recognize that before you're a Jew or a Christian or a Muslim, you are a human being and you share a common humanity.
You were just listening to Richard Forer on psycho-spiritual roots of the Israel-Palestinian tragedy. He spoke in Colorado Springs in late April. Richard Forer is the author of Wake Up and Reclaim Your Humanity, on the tragedy of Israel-Palestine. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Arundhati Roy, Ralph Nader, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Richard Forer on the psycho-spiritual roots of the Israel-Palestinian tragedy, and for his book, Wake Up and Reclaim Your Humanity, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to the Colorado Springs Justice and Peace Commission. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Bilal Abu Amne, My Tormented Heart. Mateyashtafi.